Good. So it's nice to see fewer of you this time. Must be spring break or the week before Easter or some such thing. Anyway, it feels a little more, a little less formal, at least from my vantage point. And when we're going to continue with our topic, which is the Satipatthana Sutta, and looking very meticulously at the different components, setting ourselves up to enter this sutta. And we have spent a great deal of time, virtually 3 months, orienting ourselves to the principles so that we can apply the sutta in proper alignment, and also spending the last talk and this talk on what is mindfulness as opposed to awareness, and how are those two related, and what is it that we, what are those two different components of mindfulness and awareness? And so tonight's talk is entitled From Mindfulness to Awareness. It should give you some sense of an indication of where we start and where we end up. But I'd like to pull back just for a little bit and give you a cosmology reading, if I can. And in our arrogance of several centuries ago, we once thought ourselves to be essentially the center of the universe. And it wasn't until, I think, Copernicus and maybe Galileo showed otherwise from the calculation of the stars. But the egocentric point was that all things served humankind. All other animals were subservient to humankind, and in fact the whole universe itself revolved around me and us. And so we saw ourselves as central to the cosmic design of things. And then with a little reality shone through, and we were awakened to the clear fact that the universe is vast, and that science has now demonstrated the enormous emptiness of this universe. In fact, we are a small planet in a remote part of an average-sized galaxy, and this is our star is one of about 100 billion stars within this galaxy, and there are 100 billion galaxies outside this one. So how important are we? And we're not revolving around anything. Nothing is revolving around us. We're revolving around the sun, etc. And we've actually found a more secure footing in our life patterns as well, and we don't think all animal life, hopefully, this group at least, doesn't think that all animal life is here to serve us. And that somewhat arrogant and audacious viewpoint where we will kill other life forms because they don't fit our comfort range is really a limitation of understanding that is a holdover from 400 or 500 years ago, isn't it? And so the universe, we find, when it's understood properly, has no center. It not only has no center, it has no edge. And any more than you would, if a forest covered the planet, there would be no center to the forest, would there? And there would be no edge to that forest. In some such way, if you put in another dimension somewhere, that's the way the universe lines up. And as I have spoken about before, it sum totals to zero. Now that's the current scientific understanding of the universe. If you go back 300 or 400 years, as I mentioned, it was very different. It revolved around me. And science has evolved enormously since those days of Christian and religious fixation around the center of humankind being the hub of the universe. But much of our psychic and spiritual advancement has not. We've stayed frozen in our 4 or 5 year, 100-year-old holding pattern, where we remain the fixed center of our own life, don't we? And what this sutta is attempting to do, and what all spiritual paths are attempting, the journey of the spiritual is really a journey from all me, it's all about me, to know me. N-O-me, not K-N-O-me, but to know me is to know me, I might say. And another interesting component of the universe is that time and space is actively being created as the universe expands. It doesn't expand into something. The something that it expands into comes from the very expansion itself. Right? So we can't grasp that in our mind. That's not within our ability to grasp the profundity of that. Of that statement, but that is in fact what the scientists are convinced is happening. And in fact, if you look at what the sense of self is that it actively formulates time and a sense of distance between itself and everything, actively, not passively. It sets itself up as a place and then establishes distance towards other things in relationship to itself, and time to travel that distance. If I could have everybody sit down, it would be helpful. So mindfulness, the tool we use to enter the spiritual journey, carries a sense of self within that tool. Mindfulness means I am being aware of something. It has itself, the center, it carries the center into its application, which is to be aware from me being aware of something. And that sense of self, when it's blended with awareness, because awareness itself doesn't have a center. Awareness is more like the cosmos as it's understood in present day. Awareness doesn't have a center, has no edge. In fact, it is empty, and it is very silent. Only presence. That's what awareness is. But mindfulness is, you might say, the evolution of ourselves towards awareness. And the evolution of ourselves starts 400 or 500 years ago, where we are in the controlling cockpit of and we work the levers of our attention. We place our attention here, we place our attention there, we look at things, we understand things. And so there's this ongoing monologue between ourselves and what we see. Now, whenever we blend awareness with the sense of self, which is mindfulness, are you following me? You have to be very cautious here. You have to be very suspect that there can be contamination all along the way. You can't trust your mindfulness because the mind is untrustworthy. The mind will continually bring its own opinions and experiences forth to what awareness, to what the attention is seeing within that awareness. So the fact that mindfulness holds a sense of self means that it has some sense of untrustworthiness about it, because it's being contaminated on an ongoing way by the judgments and opinions it's offering to what it sees. And we don't know when we're looking at something whether we're actually seeing it. Often we do not know, or whether we're hearing the judgments of what we see. And so there has to be this kind of suspect in our mindfulness practice. Now, so we have to keep it in line with something that we can count on, something that we know to be true. And the way we do that is that we bring mindfulness under the umbrella, in the Buddhist teaching, under the umbrella of wise view. And therefore, we have a way of knowing whether what we're seeing is an expression of the sense of self and heading in, therefore, an obscuring position, an obscuring direction, or whether it is heading in a wise direction towards the pointing of the Buddha. And so the way the Buddha frames the direction we take, we've talked about in other classes, the principles by which he points the direction that the practice is taking, can be framed as interconnectedness. It brings things together. And our mindfulness should be under the guidance of interconnectedness. So that, because the sense of self within the mindfulness is not going to be guided by interconnectedness. It's going to be guided by individuation, by isolation, because that's what the sense of self knows. So if our mindfulness is guided by isolation and individuation and opinionation, then we know we are going astray from the true path of which mindfulness is intended to take. How else are we going to know that if we don't have a guidepost or a lighthouse ahead of us showing us the direction that we need to pursue? So that's why mindfulness needs to be under the guidance of a wiser perception of life than merely our own judgments and opinions about the direction we're taking. If you're on your own and you aren't under the guidance of interconnectedness of the Buddhist teaching, then I have seen few people align themselves correctly. It gets all funny, it gets all crazy in there. And the mindfulness just follows suit. Now, mindfulness gets its energy from the sense of self. Like, okay, I've got to sit today, you know, the ambition, the need, the feeling of desire. Oh, I missed it today, I'll get it tomorrow. And I've got to sit longer, and I've got to go do a retreat. It's full of shoulds and musts. And that's how it gets its energy. And we call that discipline. And we kind of whip ourselves into shape, and some of us have that discipline, some of us don't, and some of us feel that our practice could use a stronger guidance, etc. So mindfulness gets its energy from our sense, from the sense of self and its determination. Now, awareness that is presence, that is empty, that is without the guidance of self, that is like the universe as it now exists, not the way we believed it to be 400 or 500 years ago, but as it actually is not under the energetic system of self. It's not under the disciplinarian of self. So what is it energetically that fulfills the journey when we make a transition from mindfulness to awareness? It is our intention. We have to be very clear that intention is different than willpower or volition, because willpower and volition come from me, come from my need to overcome something, from my ideas of where I'm going. But intention comes from a deep yearning within ourselves for fulfillment or completion. And that yearning, when seen in its proper orientation, is really the pull of life trying to connect with itself. It's life, because life is interconnected and we have misperceived it. That pull of the interconnection is always with us in some way or other, even though we frame life as being separate or distant from us. Nevertheless, the fact, that's the objective fact, is that life isn't that way. The subjective reality is that you are different from me. The objective reality is not that at all. It's that it's interconnected. And so the laws of interconnectedness continue to work on us internally, even as we make the assumption of separation. So how do those laws look when we make the assumption of separation? They look like I need my desire fulfilled outside myself. The bubbling intention comes up, the primary intention comes up to reconnect, to be complete. We interpret it from a mind standpoint of self and other that I need something, I need to gain something, I need to acquire something in order to be complete. So the sense of self in its distorted understanding puts completion outside of itself to ingest it in order for it to be complete. So we have to be aware of that, that completion, spiritual completion, is not going to come from the acquisition of things or from the ingestment of things. That's the distortion of the way the mind is interpreting the primary intention. Right? So we have to realign that primary intention so that it acts in accordance to where the direction of the wise view points, and that is towards interconnection. So instead of going out to look for fulfillment, we go in to look for fulfillment. We connect with the very expression of discontentment, and we find contentment within each thing that is being expressed. We don't let the expression of each thing be interpreted by the mind as some sense of incompletion that I must go out and solve, a problem that needs to be solved. I look with a sense of fulfillment towards each thing and connect with each thing fully, and therefore each no thing, when it's connected with fully, has the power to make me pursue it externally. Do you see what I'm saying? So I know this is a little wordy and detailed, but I want us to get this down so that we really understand what the spiritual path has to do with what we're doing here. Now, the definitions that you often hear of mindfulness and awareness are very subtle, but they're different. And so just listen to the definition that most people say when they're asked to give a definition of mindfulness. They'll say, mindfulness is the ability to notice what is occurring, noticing what is happening. So you hear the duality in that? There's someone noticing what is happening. So you can hear the duality within mindfulness by the very definition we give it. Now listen to the definition of awareness. Definition of awareness is knowing what is arising. So you say, well, then there's somebody knowing. No. Knowing is intrinsic to awareness itself. As I've said before, if you don't need to think about what just occurred, that you know, awareness itself knows that something just passed through the air between you and I. That doesn't have to be thought about. And awareness intrinsically knows when it knows what's arising. That's a part of awareness. And so you can rest on the fact that when you know things are arising, that is awareness working its wonder. It's called empty cognizance in Tibetan terminology. But I just like the fact, just the knowing itself. Just, it's not the intellectual knowledge, it's just the absolute knowing that something is occurring. And that's the quality of awareness. And in that, there is no duality. The knowing is not someone knowing. It's a part of the very thing itself. Now, I'd like to just, I want to read something here, because these two forms, mindfulness and the constant application of effort towards mindfulness, towards cleaning up your mind and doing all the things that mindfulness suggests you do, purification and all that, and awareness, which is the intrinsic quality that is holds all things, including mindfulness, but isn't contaminated with any sense of self. I want these two schools of thought have derived very different applications and spiritual directions. And it started, or didn't start, but it has a culmination in the 6th century in this verse. Let me just, in the 6th century, Hung Jing, the 5th patriarch of Zen, called his disciples together and instructed each to write a verse depicting their understanding of Dharma. He said he would read them and offer, he would read all the verses and offer succession to the verse with the deepest depth, with the greatest depth. The disciples returned to their cells and agreed to let the first among them, Shin Sui, take on the task of composing a verse. Though well studied in the sutras, Shin Sui was not enlightened, and the master's instructions threw him into a deep anxiety. At midnight, he produced his verses and wrote them on the wall. They read, "The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind a mirror bright. At all times we strive to polish it and let no dust alight." The next morning, the master read the verses and was not impressed. Meanwhile, Hui Nung, a poor kitchen assistant, heard about the contest and offered his own verses, posting them on the opposite wall. He wrote, "Body is no Bodhi tree, nor mind a mirror bright. Since all is inherently empty, where can dust alight?" So now you have it. You have the people who want to keep the dust from the lens, and the people who see the emptiness within the dust, and therefore there's no problem with it alighting. And these two have been seen in the past as two divisive and contradictory statements of how to practice the Dharma. But what I would suggest is that they're an evolution of understanding, much like the evolution of understanding from the cosmology of us being at the center of the universe to understanding the emptiness of the truth of the universe at present day. And that each of us have to journey that 400-year time difference between the assumption of one and the understanding of the other. And that's what spiritual practice is. We each start as the center of the universe in our practice. It's a rare person who doesn't have that as the very central core of their being, because that's all we've known life to be, isn't it? We've only known ourselves to be where all information is coming in, like the vertex of a triangle, coming into the source and the mainstay of ourselves. And so we then apply a tool that the self is fully in control of and fully control of, in order to master this problem called me, or whatever we hold the problem to be in terms of our spiritual orientation. Now, let me just say that mindfulness is a perfectly legitimate tool. I'm not persuading you against mindfulness. It's just limited. And so we have to be very suspect when we apply it, as I've mentioned. Awareness is the result. Mindfulness is the tool. Awareness is the result. How do you get the tool to the result? You get out of the way of the tool. And then the awareness that is being shown by someone becomes the awareness that is intrinsic to all things. So the whole of the practice is really to get out of the way of ourselves. Because the mindfulness, the attention, the awareness that it's, that the self is using is pristine. It's just being used by someone. And if that someone gets out of the way, that mindfulness opens up, expands outward, opens beyond the sense of the user. And so the practice is getting the sense of you out of your mindfulness. Okay? So let's just be really clear where we're moving on this thing. Now, mindfulness is, as I mentioned, a very valuable tool. And its point and purpose is to dissolve our attraction to appearances. When we start out, the sense of me is very much into the appearance of the world. And because when it designates appearances, forms, divides and looks and isolates things out from one another, it can compete against them. It can assess something. It can compare something. It can evaluate. There's a distance between it. There's a time that's served in order to get to that. So you can hear distance and time coming up. How much? How long? So if those questions come up into your meditation, it's because the sense of self is in control of the meditation. It's forming the world of distance and time from a world that doesn't hold that. Because awareness, remember, in its pristine nature, like the universe, doesn't hold time. Nor distance. If things are interconnected, how much distance can there be between things? And only when you have distance do you have time. So much of our meditation, much of our practice is to dissolve our attraction to appearances. And Buddhism is masterful in how it does that. It shows you that each appearance is limited. It's going to die and pass away. It's changing. It's impermanent. It's not trustworthy. You can't hold on to it for your life salvation if you... It's on shaky grounds and the earth is shaking underneath it. And very slowly, through the realization of that, not just through the intellectual understanding of that, through the practice of seeing everything dissolving and forming and dissolving again and again, there becomes less of an attachment towards the appearances of life. Now, the appearance of life, resting our attention upon the appearances of life, has a tremendous genetic hold on us, because that's what's given us our uniqueness. That's what's allowed us to survive as a species. That's what has set us up from other species, is the ability to examine and determine and to rearrange life according to its appearances. So it's not an easy thing to come to a sense of resolve and relaxation to the worlds of form, to releasing the tension that we hold with each aspect of form that we see. So a long period of practice is mindfulness working with each thing to settle down and to begin to relax with each thing, so that each thing doesn't, your life doesn't rise and fall upon the currents of each individual experience that you're having. Each appearance that is arising, whether it's a pleasant appearance or an unpleasant appearance, which we'll get to as we enter this sutta. And lo and behold, what mindfulness begins to see is that the sense of I is formed when it is attracted or repulsed from appearances. And it begins to see that. It says, when I really want something, there's a big I and a big D, big desire, a big I. We also begin to see that when there's a big desire and a big I, there's virtually no mindfulness. Because the big I and the big desire wipes that out. And we begin to see when we're relaxed and less contentious with life and more allowing of letting life be as it is, and therefore less invested in the appearances of life as they are arising, there's less of an I, less of a sense of me, smaller I, but a big A, awareness, is there. And we begin to understand the inverse proportion of those two things. It dawns on us. And it starts the first time we sit down in meditation and we see the difference between establishing our attention on an experience like the breath and thought about that experience, that those are two different worlds, two different domains. And that mindfulness begins to sort out the wheat from the chaff. It sees the difference. When I get lost in the opinions about it, I'm not there. And you can feel it. You're lost in thought. And you think, God, I've spent 10 minutes thinking. I haven't been on my breath. And we shake ourselves. We come back to the attention on our breath. But if you notice it, even when you're paying attention on the breath, there's still this subtle opinionation that's going on in the background. And that's called the watcher. So the watcher is being formed within our mindfulness. The watcher is some very subtle sense of opinionation about the experience we're having. And that, the mindfulness becomes very subtle in the sense of self becomes very subtle within the mindfulness formed as the watcher of the experience. Now that watcher that is established begins to become an annoying fly in your, because you can never really settle with it. It feels as if that's where you're located somehow. And it's not until we settle with it that it can be perceived as a subtle thought form. As long as you're irritated with the watcher or trying to do something about it, you're just adding fuel to the fire of the watching. And so you begin to learn that the way to step out of yourself is not through willful or volitional action, through discipline. And we've already learned that discipline is what the sense of self does to try to master anything. So how is it going to apply discipline to step out of itself? You see immediately the contradiction in that. But there is a way that awareness steps out of the watcher, or we would all be locked into the watcher for the rest of our lives. And this is at the center of the way we approach all things. I'm going very fast. I'm covering 20 talks tonight. Okay? I realize. Just hold on. Like a raft, you know? Just like, you just got a one hand on the raft and the big 12-foot waves are coming. We've gone from the universe, Copernicus. Okay. Now slowly, the watcher begins to see the mind rather than believe in the mind. And I've used the analogy before, but I think it's a good one. It's like when you have your red glasses on, everything looks red, and you don't even know that the redness that you see perceptually is caused by the glasses you're wearing, because you've worn them your whole life, you were raised with them. That's just the way the world is. The world is red. But very quietly, because the watcher becomes more subtle, the watcher, remember, is a part of the mind. Awareness is not a part of the mind. We have to get very clear on that. But when you have the mindfulness, you have the watcher applying awareness. So you have the mind and awareness in a mixture that's kind of funny. Now, as the watcher quiets down a little bit, because it sees every time it flares up that it just causes more contamination of what it's seeing, it gets very quiet and subtle. And the awareness, the objective observation, becomes more pristine because there's less noise contaminating. And as we begin to notice the mind, we're not wearing the glasses quite as strongly anymore. In other words, we've taken them off and we've kind of backed them away. We can see through them, but we can also see around them. And as the watcher becomes quieter, the glasses retreat from a total perception of life to just a perception within a perception. And you begin to see, I see. Now, what comes around this is not a new watcher, because you're watching the mind from this vantage point. And as you include more and more of the mind in the watching, the watcher loses its foothold. Awareness turns itself on the watcher itself. And that only happens when we are relatively at ease with what we see, so that there's nothing in the mind that's so disturbing anymore, so that the edges are off of it, so that we don't have to be as guarded against ourselves and what the mind's going to do to us, so that we can let down our defenses. And all of that, the awareness starts flooding out the edges of our control. We've relaxed. Just through the relaxation, the awareness starts flooding around us. And the awareness then begins to perceive the sense of watching as an object in and of itself. It knows that the watching is arising. Remember the definition of awareness. There's the knowing of the watching happening. No longer the noticing, because that's a different perception. That's a different watcher watching the watching. I'm hoping you're following this. I'm holding on just by a tentacle myself. Okay, so I want to, because of the limited time, I want to make sure that we get what I'm pointing at here. So there's not too much that you have to do to walk the evolution of mindfulness into awareness. It's not a matter of your effort. If it were a matter of your effort, and you thought it was a matter of your effort, and many of us certainly play that trump card, it just keeps you in the state of watching. All your effort does is keep you in the state of duality, because your effort is founded within the sense of self's truth, and as you apply effort, that applies the noticing of what's occurring, and my effort is that strenuous effort to notice what's occurring, and you just find yourself more and more isolated within that observation. So, as you start noticing that, I mean, the feedback is all the time. This is an all-the-time feedback. The loop has to be continuous. You're noticing what effects your practice is having on you. The Buddha said that someone who doesn't notice what their mind is doing is like an incompetent cook that doesn't care what the person needs. They're just going to feed them what they want to feed them. But when you listen to what the person needs, the customer, you might say, to what you're cooking, then you take into account what they're needing, then you cook in the right direction of what their health needs are or their whatever. So this is a continuous feedback. You see, it isn't, we've set our direction, wise view, interconnection, that's it, I never have to listen to myself again. This is a continuous feedback. And I think this is where it breaks down for many people. They think their mindfulness will just take them out. Well, it won't. Not if they're geared towards their effort and towards their own self will and volition within that mindfulness. It's not going to take you anywhere. It's just going to take you exactly where you've been, show you exactly what you've seen. We'll show you some new things, but won't let you out of that loop. We're getting into pretty subtle practice here. But we better know this going into this sutta, because this sutta is so full of commentary from 2,500 years of the ancient, dusty old monks' commentary that you can't even read it fresh. It's, most of those voices and verses have an entanglement of lots of voices, not just the Buddha's. And so we have to be the feedback machine. We have to sort the wheat from the chaff. Now let's just pick a couple of cases in point to show us irrefutably how this system works. Hopefully. Okay. Most of our spiritual effort goes into trying to remember to be mindful throughout the day. And when people are asked how they're doing in their mindfulness, they evaluate that question from the amount of effort they're extending in order to be mindful throughout the day. Well, I wasn't mindful when I was at the computer. I was mindful when I was with my child. I wasn't mindful then. I was mindful then. And that's the assessment, right? Now, so here we're going to bring in the subtlety of what we're talking about here. So the constant theme of remembering and forgetting, forgetting and remembering, plays forth throughout the early years of practice. Now, is there anyone in the room in which that hasn't played out? And which you haven't judged and belittled yourself for how little mindfulness you brought to the situation at hand and how much more effort you have to extend yourself into mindfulness in order to be and make that mindfulness happen, or whatever you might be thinking. Now let's picture the image of a pump, the analogy of a pump. The effort needed to be mindful is like the burden of pumping the water, isn't it? When the effort towards pumping stops, so does the water. And it gets burdensome, it gets hard, it gets tedious. And you think, Jesus, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. What we begin, unless you have that feedback loop going on all the time, you can play that storyline out for the rest of your spiritual days. But with the feedback loop, we begin to observe that the sense of self arises within the struggle to be mindful. That you are never more predominant, all of us, we are never more predominant than when we're trying to be mindful. And the harder we try, the more forgetful we become. Because the sense of self arises from the very effort to sustain its mindfulness. You should take this very seriously. You would, at this point, you should be willing to walk out of this room because you're not going to buy this at all. Because I am attacking the heart of your practice. That which you have held to be most sacred, your efforts to be mindful. You should be very serious about this. Like, what is he telling me? My God. You see? You see, when we begin to realize that the sense of self is the unconscious part of our mind, because well, it has to be unconscious because it's not being seen. If it were being seen, you'd never take yourself to be yourself. So when you're taking yourself to be yourself, there's a part of your mind that is completely unconscious to itself. And that complete unconscious part of yourself is trying to ascertain and to get light, to be conscious. Now, how can the unconscious try to become conscious when it refuses to shine the light on it? Trying to look out of darkness into light. And most of us are hopelessly lost within that tragedy. We are afraid to admit that the practice is not working. But we have no other practice to bring forth to make our spiritual journey advance. So it feels like we're caught in a no-person place. a no person place? I'm trying to neutralize the language here, and it doesn't make any a no man's place. See, since the sense of self is the embodiment of the absence of awareness, forgetting to observe it is inevitable if we try harder. And you see it. The harder you try, the more it slips out of your hand. Because where you have taken, what you have taken to be true is the darkness, not the light. And you have placed your spiritual methods within the efforts from that darkness to try to recover light. So let's go to a second case. I'm going to leave you there. Let's go to a second case. If we place an emphasis on me entering the here and now, this is really like, we mean. The here and now becomes the project. I'm not in the here and now. I've got to be in the here and now. Okay, let me be here and now. Let me be here and now, you see. But the sense of self, by definition, is never in the here and now, cannot be in the here and now, because it is the reflection about what is happening here and now. As I think about what the here and now contains, that forms the sense of me. Now, how can a reflection on the here and now enter the here and now? But we try to get ourselves in there. We try to abide in the here. Well, I'm going to go in. No, you can't do it that way. You see, you begin to really see what we're up against here in all of its subtlety. And I'm not holding back tonight. You're getting the full Monty. Thinking of ourselves as outside of the moment, needing to get in, is working the practice from the wrong view, the wrong intention, and the wrong effort. We're the project, not the here and now. The here and now can never have left us. I mean, just see it logically. How can the here and now leave us? It's only me that thinks its way out of the here and now. So how can the me that thinks its way out of the here and now enter the here and now? It carries the thought with itself of being outside. The here and now is quiet. The here and now is awareness. Awareness and the here and now are not two different things. You don't have to bring awareness into the here and now. The here and now manifests awareness, is awareness. So when I talk about the here and now, synonymous with that term, think of it as awareness. Those two are not different. Here and now is not a location. We begin to see that as long as I hold on myself as a responsible party to enter the here and now, or to be mindful that this thing is inevitably, has this process, this spiritual path, has to fail. Destined to fail. So when we're talking about awareness that is still, we're talking about the here and now that is still. How can the noise of me enter stillness? By being still. Because we are only held together through the noise we generate. If we see that and we're willing to release the noise, then we abide in the here and now. We don't have to go looking for it. It will find us. Because the only thing that has kept us out of us is the commentary we have about it. So the practice is to see how we're obstructing ourselves from being where we want to be located. How we're keeping ourselves disadvantaged. Rather than thinking of the disadvantaged part as seeking a strategy to be advantaged, to get over oneself or to get through oneself, or to get around oneself, or to shove oneself into it has nothing to do with the practice. Now, we have to line up our mindfulness, because we can't just be still because we hear the truth of that. Most of us still find ourselves within mindfulness and the chattering of the watcher, because we haven't seen it sufficiently. But let us now line that mindfulness up according to the standards set by awareness. Awareness holds no opinion, no judgment. It holds no discourse about anything. It just simply is presence. And therefore, our mindfulness also has to be aligned with that purpose and intention, not to constantly comment on everything. And that the comment keeps me back reflecting upon what I see. And it keeps the sense of me alive within what I see, the sense of me, I, because the sense of I is a thought believed. That is all the sense of I is. And awareness adds nothing to the moment. It doesn't try to wiggle out or distort whatever is arising. It simply is a complete relaxation, a sense of presence, an abiding within what is arising. And therefore, our mindfulness must follow suit, add nothing to this moment when we're sitting, which is nothing. Our mind is lost in thought, nothing is added. The intention, the primary intention will realign you. Not your admonition, not your self-beratement, not your self-condemnation, your judgment. Only your intention will bring this back. Add none of that to this. Awareness is trusting, because it's a complete acceptance, allowance of things being the way it is. There's no distortion within awareness whatsoever. So our mindfulness must be prone and aligned with absolute honesty, denying nothing. And you can now see why the precepts are so essential all along the way. But certainly you would never even get to this point if we were not integritous. Mindfulness without deceit, without distortion, without adding anything to it. Then, as things are added, we will perceive them, because our intention is not to add anything. When things are added, you'll say, oh, there's something being added here. And then awareness will begin to see what is being added. And when it begins to intend to see what is being added, it will see itself as the added ingredient. And then, not through force of will, it will shut up. And it will die a sane death. And I've held you too long tonight. Can we sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, you see, even if you're adding something and you see it, don't add anything else. Don't let there be any kickback from what you've added already. It's all okay. You see, that's the nature of faith. Is that there's a realization that everything is trustworthy. And that this has its own life. It has never been your life that has gotten you this far, and it won't be your life that completes it at some point. It'll be life, the life that's in you that completes itself, the journey of seeing itself, of touching its own face. And the less we interfere, the quicker that will occur. Okay.